Welcome. I wanted to check and see how we're doing quorum-wise. Let you know, Alan Packard is here for Richard Bay, so he'll be voting for Richard Bay today. Rachel Otto is here for Cameron, so she'll be voting for him. Dave Decker isn't here. Ed Bowler's on the phone. Representative Coleman's here. Mark Stratford, is he still out in the hall? Paulina Flint's here. Tom Ward's here. And I'm here. Okay. So we're missing Dave Decker and Mark Stratford at this point.
And Scott Martin calling.
Yeah, Scott Martin's on the phone, as well as John Maybe is on the phone with Ed Bowler. Can you hear me okay on the phone?
Yes.
Okay. We'll try to switch it around. I didn't know until yesterday that they were going to be on the phone, so we didn't get very good arrangements for that, but we'll make the best of that. With that, I sent out an agenda Friday. If you didn't get one, there's some on the chair over there if you'd like to grab one. So we'll get started and start walking through issues. My presumption is that time for discussing is ending and the time for decision making is starting. So that's kind of the way the agenda is structured today. Largely, we'll see what happens from that. First, Representative Coleman had indicated at the last meeting that she would like to have legislative research look at our observations, or my observations, and tell us if there were issues, legal, they had differing legal opinions. I don't know if you've had a chance to do that.
I think my questions have prompted even more discussion, more questions.
Okay.
For them, and they are deep into, also reviewing the cases that are frequently referenced here, but also another one that they're just starting to dig into. So they don't have an affirmative comment yet, but probably pretty soon.
Okay. So do you want to give us a hint of which part of this they're having trouble with or looking at?
So we have the Constitution has restrictions on municipalities. This is Section 6 on what they can do with their rights, their shares, their waterworks, their sources. So there's still the looming question about the commodity itself. And there's only, it appears to be one case that sort of taps that a little bit. The other cases that we reference in here really are fairly quiet on the constitutional provisions and rely heavily on the statutory provisions. And where a case may not include that scope, it doesn't. They just haven't gone there. So, Flatt and Torrey, those are the ones we talk about a lot. Again, rely on the statute. Don't really address the constitutional provisions. And the third case we just became aware of, a 1938 case. Maybe you know what that one is. Sort of touches on that, but we're not. We're looking at how strong that is and where it's maybe been applied to other cases. But it would seem that the Constitution intends that there is some restriction on municipalities to control water, hold water, and what the stated restrictions are on the other pieces of that for extra jurisdictional distribution, does that include water? So right now, the people who have been around this table and in these discussions, even outside of this meeting, are interpreting that it does not include the commodity. And that might be the most strict interpretation. So we're still looking into that, because that would be important to understand where we have some municipalities that have amassed incredible amounts of water that then distribute outside of their jurisdiction. Can they, should they?
Okay.
So that's an underpinning, I think, of everything else we end up discussing without that piece firm.
Yes.
I was thinking about this issue of cities that might sell water versus the question that's been posed of hoarding water and water requirements. One that I haven't heard cited, may have been cited in this group, is 73.1-1-4, paragraph 2. Those in the public water supplier industry are aware of what's called the 40-year requirement, okay, so with the state engineer. So that is one of those provisions that bars us from keeping water that we don't require. And when we talk about the surplus water, we need it in 40 years, but until that 40 years, we might have surplus water. I thought that was an important distinction on how we effectively, on the ground, manage our water and conjunctively manage it between public water suppliers. Back to the league's list of a couple dozen plus that actually have these contracts. It doesn't mean we can hoard it so that we can sell it. It's we've acquired it for our 40-year plan,
right.
And then in the interim, we're allowing growth to occur that's adjacent to our water facilities or our city, that sort of thing.
Right. So have we sort of created for ourselves that conflict to say you can have it, but if you can't put it to beneficial use in that interim time before you have experienced that 40-year build-out, then you're almost forced to do something with it. So we've got to put it to beneficial use somehow. And so that is, in some cases, being affected through extra-jurisdictional distribution.
So that same statute, was it 5 or 6 years ago, had a provision that in the past, about 15 years ago, you had entities using water they didn't need in order to preserve it from forfeiture. However, the statute was amended that said if a municipality, a public water supplier, has a 40-year plan, that preserves that water resource from forfeiture. So you didn't have this backwards, people using water in a strange way.
Right.
So that was a really good piece of legislation that I think addresses some of the concerns that I've heard in terms of a hoarding versus a surplus water contract. The way that we talk about it is a conjunctive use, and we're disallowed from hoarding, and we're required to update our 40-year plan. And if things change, then those water rights then are subject to forfeiture. So the statute already forces us to release.
Right.
I haven't thought about that. What if we have too much water rights? We can't sell it because of the Constitution.
Yeah, you can't sell it.
Yeah.
My experience so far is it's pretty easy to be creative about a 4-year plan.
So that would be my question, too, is what we're talking about on the policy side is that a standardized and reliable and valid is that standardized across the board? Can a city just say, here's our 40-year projections? And I guess that would go back to your office. How that is defined when those plans are submitted, are they reliable on the basis of consistent standards from city to city, plan to plan? So we can say, yes, that is a valid 40-year projection versus are we getting into a space that maybe not so much?
So I think you touch on a couple of things, because one thing that's left to the discretion of, I think it's the relationship of a municipality or a development area and the water supplier. One group may choose a very aggressive water conservation program, and you multiply people times amount of water per person. That's your water need. The statute does not require that, and ironically, some of those cities that are saying others are hoarding water, they haven't gone to the conservation route first. And so their 40-year plan may say they need water, but it may be a much higher gallon per capita, because they're not conserving. So although that, you know, that's public policy versus at a state level dictating what a local government may do. Does that make sense? You know, the statute does not require them to conserve. If they choose to purchase extra water, which is very expensive now, to have New England landscapes on the edge of the desert, that's just a choice that they make. The statute doesn't dictate that. It just says if they're planning to do that, they need to show the water supply in the 40-year plan. Does that make sense?
So it seems to me that there should be a public policy that ensures a prohibition on hoarding that recognizes valid 40-year plans that are reliable, valid. And so to say, well, it just depends what this city wants, a more conservative model in their projections, and this one is, you know.
But the statute addresses exactly what you're talking about. Is it says you must, in order for you to retain that water right, you must have a 40-year plan that shows, boy, help me, the reasonable need of the public. So it actually shows, we've done the math on our projected growth within Salt Lake, Sandy, West Jordan, Kanab, and here's our population growth. Most entities tie it to the state population forecasts and growth forecasts, and then that dictates how much growth they're going to have. Then they do some math and say, we're going to conserve X amount. That's left to the discretion of the local community. So I know Salt Lake and Sandy are very aggressive on their conservation. St. George is very aggressive. There are other entities that aren't as aggressive. But they may be forced, like here, I'll give you with Sandy City. We've been forced, if we continue without further conservation, our next block of water is going to cost us about $50 million. And so I find it a little bit, it's a wake-up call to the newer communities. They're saying, oh, water's so expensive and individuals are hoarding, yet they haven't taken the level of conservation that they might as an option. Instead, they're saying, we want the cheap water. The cheap water is not available to even a Sandy or Salt Lake now. We're having to buy it at the same price as everyone else. So we're looking at conservation. So the statute in place, under 73.1-4, puts the limitation on the hoarding on the 40-year plan. The piece that's discretionary throughout statutory and public policy right now is what conservation goal you might have. But even the state, the governor's goal, to my knowledge, the only requirement are those that are petitioned through Central Utah Water Conservancy District have to meet that state, the governor's goal of 25% by 2025. Yeah, thank you. Anyway, I think that's a distinction that when you talk about the hoarding piece, that's covered already under 73.1-4. It's just if you're going to require someone to conserve themselves out of it or buy themselves out of that and dictate that from the state legislature versus allowing a community to decide. That's probably more of a decision point than something that's already been tread upon or supports what you're looking for.
So let me maybe rephrase my question. Maybe rephrase it as a question. I think you're saying that there's discretion in the creation of that plan. And this is one of those times where we really like the local control. Right.
How much
I'm
do they want to
control.
Conserve?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But for the state engineer's office, is there, what does the enforcement piece look like? What does your decision-making piece rely on to determine that 40-year? Is it just simply that they submit a plan and it looks like the statute only requires a plan that is reasonable? But where does that reasonable standard come in when you make your decisions? And should we have more clarification on it so we know it's not hoarding, it is within a reasonable plan?
Let me explain a couple of things. First, we only see those 40-year plans when an entity is in a situation where they're required to submit them, and the most common case is when they need to extend a water right beyond 50 years. So they've already filed a change or an application to appropriate. It's gone along, and it's been over 50 years since they filed the application and we approved it. And then to continue to extend past 50 years, they're required to file their plan. So we don't see most of the city's plans. We don't even know if they have one. We only know the ones that have had to extend a water right beyond 50 years. And our standard is really, it's a moving target, because your 40-year plan today will be different than your 40-year plan 10 years from now. And so we receive the plans, we look at them to see if they pass the smell test, that it looks reasonable, and that's all we do with it.
And I would just like to add maybe something else to that. I mean, even if it's unreasonable from the state engineer's perspective, the state engineer doesn't then force you to do something. If your water right is going to go away because of a failure to use, that's up to other water users to address, or to be addressed potentially maybe in a general adjudication action. But a court is the one that determines if your water right is forfeited for non-use. When we're talking about 7314 and the 40-year plan, that's a protection from somebody asserting forfeiture against anybody's water right. Now, it turns out that farmers have a whole different kind of series of things in that list that apply to them than apply to municipalities. So the 40 and or to public water suppliers, which is more than municipalities. There are lots of ways that we're talking about that people try to protect their water rights from an assertion of forfeiture, but that shouldn't be confused automatically with the thing we're talking about here, dealing with with service of water outside of municipalities' boundaries. And so I'm a little concerned that whole discussion is getting us away from at least what this committee is supposed to be discussing. They're important questions, but I don't know that our committee was tasked with addressing that particular issue of a 40-year plan and a level of service and how do we deal with forfeiture, except to the extent that that helps inform us about how should we be dealing with this question that we are tasked with answering.
I think, if I can speak, Representative Coleman, I think that was one of the things that you identified as a policy concern that you mm-hmm. wanted answered, and I pointed to this legislation because it's the closest thing I'm understanding that keeps, as you mentioned, Boyd, keeps those that are in the process of certifying their water rights, improving up on those, keeps them honest to the issue that Representative Coleman brings up of hoarding, right? I'm looking around the room, and I would, I'm not familiar with, but I'd like to know, under statute or rule, a water master plan requirement that says we have to have a master plan updated on a regular basis, and that we show for our defined service area that we have an adequate water supply. And I think if we do, great. The next thing would be a good cross-reference to your statute, Boyd, under 7314, so that ties into that 40-year plan, so they're consistent. In practice, I know, Laura, you do this, we do this at Sandy City, we have a 40-year plan be kind of an exhibit to our master plan, so it meets the state engineer's requirements. But as Mark mentioned, it's kind of written around this forfeiture issue. But in the end, it's, do you have enough water rights to meet your need? And I think it also applies, do you have too much water rights to support, you know, in your case, Boyd, you're saying an application at hand. I think in a way that aligns with what Representative Coleman, you're looking for, is something in statute or rule and in practice that on a regular basis we can look at our water requirements and do we have a plan, not only for hoarding, but also when I practiced in Washington State, they had an instance where a city sold out too much to a developer and the city went dry because they didn't have enough.
Right.
So it's a list of those rights. Boyd, you bring up a good point too, that at least for the cities I'm very familiar with, Sandy and Salt Lake City, as we've been updating, we said we used to say we needed more water, but as our conservation gets better and better, that more water gets less and less. And so technology and the practices in our community of conservation, it becomes a dynamic thing. But if there is in either Division of Drinking Water or Water Rights Statute something that requires a master plan that says your water needs being met, both to keep from hoarding as well as to keep a city honest to meeting the needs of the public and not overextending their development at the peril of existing customers.
So I really think the area where this is getting addressed going forward is probably something that was just passed last year, Representative Sandals' source sizing bill.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So going forward, the drinking water will set individual system standards, and those standards will be based on historic use. And so if there's a concern that people have unrealistic levels of service, I think there's no specific mandate there about how you acquire water, but the standards are going to be set based on historic use, and that's really going to be what's going to guide us going forward. I think to try and jump out there and change a whole bunch of other stuff while we're trying to implement source sizing standards, and then those can be used to define some of these questions, I really think we need to let that play out because it's almost brand new, and it's not even going to be implemented for a year because the data to make those standards applicable is still being gathered and submitted both this year and next year, at which point drinking water can then step forward with that. And so that we need, I think, let that thing breathe a little bit before we jump too much on top of it.
And that's a good point. I mean, that is exactly one of the things driving a new water supply and demand and major conveyance study for Salt Lake City. Because we have to have that engineering study to Division of Drinking Water by March of next year. And so I think that's going to drive a lot of people's look at municipal water supplies and their system service area. So.
Yeah, and I agree. That's a totally new process. Mm-hmm. And whether I have some pessimism in my mind about how long it will endure, but but it's going to take time to see if it even is going to work. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I think just for the committee's information, as we were negotiating that piece of legislation last year, a lot of changes were made during the negotiation process. But the bottom line, which makes it more difficult to try and have a standard, is that each individual city can establish their own standard.
Correct.
Demand.
Yeah.
And with a few exceptions, and so a demand for Ivins may not be the same demand for Salt Lake City.
Yes.
And probably shouldn't be. But so that when Representative Sandel was running that bill, we worked very closely with him and with Marie and the others to try, and the state fire marshal and a number of other people, to try and get those numbers as best we could. But we recognized when we walked out of there that we had established a system that would allow every city to establish their own demands, which would then impact each of the cities in their four-year water plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
One of the main purposes of us coming together was to deal with the outside city's water users. And we have a number of pages of definitions in the state glossary that deal with the functionality of water, the origin of water, how you maintain the right. There's a plethora of information about the water right and the ownership, but there's nothing in there that talks about what is retail water supplier, other than in one section of the code, and that's under the fluoride and functionally separate, and it says it only references one who owns or operates a public water system. That's not defined enough to the point of protection for the water users. You have the retail water definitions, the wholesale water definitions that need to be addressed, the water user itself. You have to understand inside, outside supplier, and is there fairness and equity for on both sides of that dividing line? And if you're providing retail water service, you have to provide a map of where you provide that service. Those are your customer base. We are treating water more like a wholesale, and we keep talking wholesale to everyone. You have to talk about the end user. Are they being treated fairly? Could we do better? Is there a master plan for improvements, inside, outside? Delineating finances that are collected, inside, outside. Those are transparency questions that all brought us to this table. To get into water law, that's already defined. It's defined to the point that everybody in this room, if they were honest, would say they're scared to death to have any more conversations about the water right. You know, we're all sitting here wondering if we have too much or too little, or how are we going to deal with it, and what do we say in front of the water rights folks that manage it and the state engineer. Everybody has that paranoia in this state. But we're also forgetting that as a wholesale, as a retailer, we're providing a service. And we need definitions for providing that service that... Are we operating in fair, good conscience? Is there equal treatment? And a lot of this discussion has come from people being afraid that they're going to be shut off. There have been statements made. There are public record of statements being made. And that's what brought us to the table, the fear that people someday, because the city might need or I might need water and I'll shut it off for somebody else that's outside our boundaries, and we have to assure that customer base that they have the opportunity to have continued water. We cannot hide behind the Utah Constitution anymore to say, I own, you're the renter, so be it. And that is in an email right out of the people that are claiming it's not happening. So I'm sorry. We need to get back to getting those definitions. And I think we were asked to come with some possible definitions. I had a long conversation with Tom over at our water office to say we need to get back to this.
Okay.
Everybody's searching for it. The state is, because if a complaint comes in, how do you address it if you have no rules or guidelines? We've got to develop guidelines.
Boyd?
Yes.
So I think the issue, this is an important issue about hoarding and other things, but I think it's not going to be solved this year. The water hoarding, we have to wait for the new reports in March of next year, see where we're at.
I think the standard's so fluid right now, it's hard to...
We need to understand that even if a city was hoarding water, it's really not that harmful because the water is being used. It's being used by others.
Yeah.
It's a question of water priority, you know, when it comes down to it. The real question in my mind is the constitutional issue and getting into the nitty-gritty at this point in time. And one of the reasons I came is I wanted to find out what this committee thinks about the constitutional amendment.
Yep.
And is the league getting close on solving their waterworks issue? Because...
Yeah. So... And I guess I would entertain a motion if someone wants to make it about whether we are going to discuss hoarding or let that go for another year or period of time, recognizing that standards are changing. Does anyone want to make a motion?
I think that should continue to be part of our discussion.
Okay.
So I move that. That remains on the table as a topic of discussion.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about that, though? So are we, I mean, as a topic of discussion versus as something that we intend to develop some kind of proposal for? I think discussing it and having it out there is fine, but I'm afraid that if we, does that include trying to develop some kind of language?
I would say it includes that if the discussion leads to a policy proposal, absolutely. Ideally, we would discuss it with consideration of a policy proposal as an option. I don't think... being probably the newest person in the room to this water world, there's so much there, but there's some things that we just have to continue to have context for. And I think they're, I think the nature of our arid state requires that we have a comprehensive understanding of our water availability and our water distribution. So that includes how that's being distributed, how it's being planned, how it's being acquired. So I realize all of that is big, big scope, but I think that we need to keep it out there to provide context for the other policies that we're likely to do.
I'd just like to interject something here. We've been talking about the city developing a 40-year plan and holding that water for future use. And what's happened when they do that is they go up, in my case, it's up in the canyons, and buy the water for this 40-year projection of growth, and they end up becoming a monopoly of, you know, they end up owning pretty much all the water up there. They become, in essence, the water supplier for the folks that live up in the canyon. I mean, you know, they can't be treated as if they're just some other person that they're just selling water rights to, because the people up in the canyons don't have any other choice. They can't go and buy their water from somebody else. So, in essence, the city becomes the utility for that area. And so it would seem to me that if you've got to recognize that they've already said they're not going to cut off our water. They say that, but that in their documents they say they can. And it's they're playing this game of calling it one thing and it really is something else. It needs to be described as they're the utility. They end up being the utility because they bought up all the water up there. They previously supplied it. They bought up water companies, and they were supplying the people up there. Now they have become that. They de facto have become the utility for those people up there. And that has to be brought into the 40-year projection. That has to be added on. So if the city is truly going to say that we'll never cut off your water, then if they have a 40-year projection that is including that water that is now being delivered to the folks in the canyon, they got to go out and find some other water to accommodate that, so that you would never have the possibility of that water being cut off to the people in the canyons. So I think, in my estimation, that once this any entity, and it, Salt Lake City or any other entity, either a private or public, becomes a monopoly on any utility that services people, they should be falling under the Public Service Commission, because that's the only one that regulates whether things are reasonable or not. And if there's any piece of legislation that we could project right now, that would be the one I would recommend, that any we make a definition about what constitutes a service provider or a service area, and then we and once that's defined, then any utility that falls underneath that has to go before underneath the PSC.
Okay. Well, and we clearly have a situation where we're at today that, because of the way the Constitution is written, if you're providing water outside your city limits, it's got to be construed as surplus water. That's just where they're stuck because of the Constitution. And so that's one of the reasons that the Constitution Committee wrote their proposal to change the Constitution, because I don't think they can give you an assurance. They can say that, but I don't think they can really give you an assurance, because of the way the Constitution is written, that they can provide water if it's needed for their city down the road.
Why can't they extend the service area? Why can't they expand the service area and just...
You do that by annexing. right
currently.
Now.
The segue, I think that's maybe a good jumping point to the constitutional amendment. I read that, and I'll leave it to the experts here that are authors of that. I thought it brought out some really good pieces of that definition of the service area, and I can't remember if that amendment talked about equal treatment within that service area. That's, as I understood from the last meeting, there were some pieces that they thought were better left maybe to this committee to define the equitable treatment. You know, for a service area, there's equitable treatment. There might be differential rates, but there needs to be some reasonable rationale for that.
So if it's all right, I agree that, I mean, I think we're starting to get to the other issues that are on the agenda, and we'll leave open the issue of water hoarding and if we need to do something about that, because nobody wanted to make a motion about doing something otherwise, and continue to have opportunity to discuss that in the committee. But if everyone's okay, we'll move on to the next agenda item and start to talk about what the proposal is. And
I think that Representative Coleman's thoughts, I think, are spot on, that, you know, hoarding water in the West would not be a good thing. The one thing I would ask is, as we think about that, is in the West, as in any place, you know, look at an entity like, is it Panguitch, that has one water supply. So there's your main source that has some level of reliability and unreliability. And most progressive water utilities have a certain level of redundancy and supplemental water. Yeah. And so we need to be thinking about that hoarding doesn't mean that you have more than what you pump on your biggest day. You have something if you have a well go out or your watershed catch on fire. And the way we've gotten around that is, again, back to this constitutional amendment, allowing the continuing agreements between public water suppliers and cities and other entities so that they can share. That happens on a regular basis, you know, that between Metro Central Utah, Jordan Valley, and 20, 30 other cities in the state, we have those agreements. But I think along Representative Coleman's lines, if there's hoarding that's happening, that's a bad thing. But we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yep. All right. Yes.
One other very brief comment, but while I'm not sure what hoarding is, it's kind of anybody's definition, I suppose. But even if water were forfeited because of perceived hoarding, it's not going to generate water. All of our water rights, all of our streams are over-appropriated. The Jordan River system, million acre feet maybe in that magnitude. So all that water would do is go to satisfy other existing water rights. It doesn't deal with
just like it is today.
So I'm not sure where all that dialogue even gets us, because at the end of the day, the water is appropriated in the state. We don't have a surplus water. We got to deal with what we have.
Yeah, and I would agree that you may have water rights you're not exercising, but if you're not, somebody else is. Nobody's got a big vault anywhere they're storing this water in.
Well, let me go along the line of that. What's happened now is we have these surplus agreements. So I'll give the example. Metropolitan of Salt Lake and Sandy and Jordan Valley Water Conservancy partner and share water back and forth. So water that might be surplus to West Jordan one year that ends up in Sandy might be surplus to Sandy in another year and end up in West Jordan. If we upend that apple cart, both of those entities suddenly put themselves at the bottom of the list that Steve Clyde's mentioning. So, while the hoarding issue would be bad, I think there are ways that we've addressed that, and we need to be very, very careful about not creating unintended consequences of the fabric that's been built over 150 years of good water management. A couple of things we've learned over we've had lawsuits over time, and we've learned from those. So,
okay.
Hey, Boyd.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm going to keep my comments from the phone very, very brief and singular. But a couple things. One is, I'm with Steve in that I don't quite understand the quote-unquote hoarding idea. To the extent I do, it's very much addressed in recent legislation that's indicated in 73-1-4. And also, you know, the point of sharing, you know, hoarding means, at least in my concept, hoarding allows for sharing. That's why, you know, $250 million projects like the Metro Water Project are constructed so that water can be moved throughout the valley. not just on the east bench, but over to the west side of the valley as well. And then the last thing that I wanted to make was the idea of monopoly is not contrary to sound watershed management. The Utah Supreme Court has spoken to that issue and very, very clearly, most recently in the Big Ditch case. And I would suggest that, you know, those that still have a concern about the term monopoly, go ahead and read, I think it was the fifth cause of action in that case, and go ahead and read how the Utah Supreme Court handled that issue. Anyway, thanks a lot for letting me show up by phone. I really appreciate this anyway.
All right. Thank you, Scott. All right. Is it all right if we move?
I have one additional comment. I believe that the terms monopoly and hoarding are being generated by very dissatisfied retail water users. So to waste our time on discussions of hoarding and monopolies is just deferring what work needs to be done. And it goes again to the end user. If you are providing a pipeline to bring water to a daily customer that's paying you a bill, that's your retail water service. And you need to define that by presenting a map. That was the big one of the big questions in Representative Coleman's legislation. Define it. Show it. People need to have certainty. All of this other is subterfuge to take us down a road to kill time and get us nowhere. It will not solve the problem of the dissatisfied retail water user. So let's define it, put this argument to rest. We can go another 100 years talking about hoarding and monopolies, and it'll get you nowhere other than insulting everybody. Because we all provide water to people outside our jurisdiction. It's how you treat that customer base that's bringing us to this table. And we either face it, deal with it, make it work. I'm tired of sitting here talking about things you can't fix.
Me too.
It's an attitude problem. And solve the attitude problem by being a good public servant.
All right. We ready to move on to the Constitution? Let's move there. We did distribute the proposed constitutional amendment last meeting. I presume you've had a chance to look at that. I don't know if Steve wants to help us understand what the features of the change are.
We can go back through it again, but it is an effort to essentially validate what's currently happening rather than make them walk that fine constitutional line. We've addressed three different facilities. One is already in existence with a constitutional provision allowing the exchange of water or water sources or systems of equal value. The other is the retail service expansion, where a city has actually run its distribution lines, is providing water under a service contract as it does to its inhabitants. And the third would be a legitimate surplus water sale, where there is no existing retail system and no capacity to retail water. So, as the Canyon example, Salt Lake would have entered into surplus sales agreements and made water available there, and it simply validates those concepts constitutionally, which the statute has already allowed. And that's really all it does, is an attempt to validate what we're currently doing.
And it strikes the word lease, so there's not confusion about
actually
whether that happens.
No, it may come back, yeah.
Oh, that's being discussed, though.
Let's just say we're having some discussion on that because we don't want to create any confusion on the parts of the board.
Okay.
But we still have to go and talk to the league as a whole, and we'll have our league meetings in September, and we'll have some proposed language, I think, as a committee prior to that, but we still have some internal discussion, but what you have before you, I believe, reflects most of our changes. I'm not sure if you have before you the most recent changes where we've changed the word sell and insert the word commodity and supplying of the commodity of water, because we want to make it clear that as cities, we're not removing that prohibition on selling the water rights. And so we're just trying to clear that, make that clearer, I guess. I know you've got a lot to discuss, so as we go along and discuss this, we can fill you in a little more on it. But I think you generally have what we're proposing in front of you.
I think, Boyd, one of the things that's important about the amendment, we'll have debates about one word here or one word there, lease and waterworks, et cetera, some of which the league has to decide what they want to do. But one of the critical things we've added to the constitutional amendment is the recognition of a service area. That is new. The recognition that a city will designate a service area.
Yeah.
And that in which everyone within that service area is treated the same, in effect, their customers, of the utility. Now, that's important for this perspective, for this committee, because then this committee has to look in the statutory language and make sure how people within that area are going to be treated fairly. So you can address some of the statements made by senators and others of the taxation without representation issue. So that's a statutory issue. That's how what I saw this committee having to deal with. That's what's important, because we have to keep in mind that the people that will be carrying the bills are the legislators, not us. We won't be carrying those bills. It's what Representative Coleman wants to do. It's what Senator, there's a few others out there that will be carrying bills, and if we want input, this is the time to do it.
Well, yeah, and if we want good ideas to end up in their hands, then now's the time to bring those ideas forward.
So the question, one question this committee needs to address, do you like the concept of the city's defining a service area? Is that a good approach?
Yes.
So that's what I want to hear.
And in that language, we've said, I don't know if your draft has it in there, but it's an authorization to supply water within that designated service area. But obviously this is the Constitution, so we're not going to get into the details, and that's, again, what we're looking for is for you all to come up with the statutory language that says what you can do in that
service area
and what the requirements would be, and then we would follow those statutes.
And we need somebody to draft that for us.
Well, I think that's the spring point of the agenda topic. I guess a question for me would be, like, say Norm's instance, how do you see constitutionally allowing that, and then the treatment of that, either in statute.
At the last meeting, it was stated that there would be a companion bill to the statutory that would give those definitions. So that's not that hard. Legislators, we just need somebody to script the first draft for those definitions to be the companion bill to whatever decisions made on the constitutional change.
Well, I think there is a distinction. There's in the constitutional amendment, it talks about the city declaring a service area where they provide service, and then it's clear that they have to treat those people like customers. The constitutional provision addresses if they have surplus water, they can enter into contracts with people outside their service area, but it doesn't say anything about an ongoing commitment. It's still surplus water.
But a contract is more like wholesale. It's not retail.
Yeah. Someone's saying something on the line?
Someone on the phone have something?
Yeah. This is John Navy. I thought Fred Finlayson's draft statute was addressing these very issues. Would be the companion legislation to amending the Constitution. Am I wrong?
Yeah, he does have a proposal, and we'll get to that on addressing some of these issues. And so I'm just trying to get to a point where we understand what the proposed constitutional amendment is, and then hopefully someone's going to make a motion to whether we support it or not.
So, Representative Coleman, do you?
Okay, thank you.
Does the constitutional amendment kind of give the framework that you think we needed, and then, you know, as the agenda that you have before us, you know, we talk about the details of statutory, but on the amendment, is that, are there?
So I think that, I mean, I think this addresses the concerns that the Constitution, my question is, we seem to be wanting to change the Constitution to comport with current practices.
And that's what's been proposed,
which assumes that there are violations of the current Constitution provisions in this area, or we wouldn't be seeking to have it conform to. So as a policymaker, when I consider that, and you guys are on the ground, and I work a policy from 30,000-foot view, that begs a lot of questions right there. So our exercise here, not to detour this, boy, sorry, but this just triggers my, you know, the brain center on principle. That we're even discussing, we need to change the Constitution to comport with practices. Assumes that then practices do not comport with current Constitution. So I think that this direction solves some of the problems, but it sure begs new questions. Do we just gloss over by doing this? So I think that with this, assuming this is the route we're going to go, we have a constitutional. A bill that reflects the constitutional change proposal and a bill that then affects the statutory scaffolding of that, what we're trying to achieve in the Constitution. My brain is just going, you know, just still asking if this is even the right direction that we go, but it looks like this where it's probably one of the easier ways to go right now with the least amount of complication.
We clearly have a lot of people who are feeling uncertain, and this is probably the best way to give those people a feeling of certainty.
Right.
That currently have contracts of similar
yes.
nature.
Yeah. Well, yeah, receiving service outside the municipal boundaries.
So in my mind,
it does leave some questions with your group.
It band-aids the, well, probably band-aid is not the right word either, but it's sort of the fix that we can touch right now. It doesn't touch on the fact that we have practices that are not consistent with the statute, with the Constitution. And does anybody care?
Well, I think it goes back to me what Boyd is saying. It's the agreements that I'm familiar with that are party to party, municipality to municipality, or district to district, especially when you talk about a city, it's a lease that's been written very closely to be honest to the Constitution, but it's making that water available to others. And there's a couple of different ways that water might be available. One is an entity like Sandy or a Salt Lake or any entity that has planned for growth and acquired their water supply now for 40 years or some time period, they have that water that might be available. There's another reason that water might be available and utilized under these agreements. Most water rights in Utah, or many of them, are tied to a stream flow, and many of those may produce more or less in a certain year. So on the years that it produces more, rather than letting that water go down the system, and as Boyd and Steve mentioned, that just goes to the next appropriator, a city or other entity can enter an agreement that allows that extra water, that surplus water, surplus only because it's a wet year, to become available to the other entity. Many of our storage projects are built off of those types of that framework. So I don't want you to think that the existing Constitution and practice is wrong. It has been very important to allowing us to grow in the state of Utah in the most efficient manner. It's just the issue, as Boyd mentioned, some of the entities, I think some of your constituents brought this to your attention, we were concerned about these contracts that had kind of this I don't know what the right word was, respecting the Constitution, kind of put in language that was did not make them feel good, made them feel at risk. So I think that was the objective, as I understood it, of the constitutional amendment, not to make something that's wrong suddenly right, not that. It's to give comfort to those entities that are benefiting from surplus agreements, that now those agreements have much more, can be longer standing and recognized. Because as mentioned, if their agreement falls away, now they go to the bottom list. Their water resources, all their surplus contracts, they have, as opposed to having a contract that they have an understood reliability of, suddenly has zero benefit. They've lost that ability to, it upends a very efficient system within the state of the collective. Like, why do we gather together? It allows us to share our resources.
So my concern is with this direction, and I'm probably not going to oppose this direction, but I just want to put my concern out there. Is the concern for the word monopoly has been used by, now I didn't use the words hoarding or monopolies today, other people did, asserted those first. If the concern is the potential for monopoly behavior, changing this seems to allow where a boundary and a restriction is not jurisdictional, but service area. So service area can just sprawl in an unlimited way. Do we then invite that? And that's what concerns me, is changing from municipal boundaries or municipal inhabitants to anyone being served in a district allows just almost a limitless expansion of that municipal's distribution of water. Where we still have other questions outstanding, this is where I think, we can't ignore that 40-year plans are not consistent, reliable, or even disclosed or reported or updated or submitted. That's just my concern. I just want to put out there is, does this change then allow for more potential for abuse? And not saying that there's abuse, but could it, where it's been asserted that there's monopolistic type behavior, and I heard from somebody today that monopolies aren't all that bad.
So
that might be the quote of the day.
If I can respond to, I think, Representative Coleman, I think you brought up some important issues, because what's the difference between having a supplemental supply in a case of emergency if someone's a source goes out, as opposed to a true monopoly of all the water resources? One element that I don't know if this is in statute, but it talks about reliable. As an engineer, we do hydrology, and we say statistically, in a drought, in a 10-year drought, this supply will provide a reliable yield, a reliable amount of supply every 10 years, or you pick 20 years or something. And so that's a reliable yield. And then everything above that is extra. So 9 years out of 10, there's going to be more than the reliable yield. But what you don't want to do is have to tell everyone to move away and close their businesses when you don't have their reliable yield. In a 40-year plan or other benchmark, and the standard of practice is you establish that reliable yield. And I think Washington and Idaho statute, they require a reliable yield in their master plan, and that becomes the basis for their master plan, which is for growth, but also the measure for the water rights that they might hold, right? And I guess where I'm thinking, to address your concern, Representative, I think tying that practice and rules in play in terms of reliable yield, and then what do you do with the extra years, having the ability to have a surplus contract, as this constitutional amendment would affirm that good practice allows that extra. But if an entity is holding more than they need for their reliable yield, is that hoarding? Now, the other example I will give you, in the state of Washington, it requires, does not allow, it requires a city to have a reliable yield to support the growth that they have and requires them to do that with their largest supply out of service. In their instance, they had a Panguitch situation where they didn't have a backup supply. So it's not just reliable yield, it's reliable yield, and if something happens, I know in Sandy we've had 5 of our wells get contaminated, so that was our reliable yield, and suddenly we're looking for places to replace that. But I think there's some language there. There's enough, you know, knowledge and experience in this room that either can tease out of an existing statute and rule, or it might be something that we could ask the representative to clarify for us. So I know Pauline had something too.
I think as far as this last statement that you just made, Tom, I think we call that in the industry the capacity to serve. That no matter what happens, do you have the capacity to serve the rest, the service area that you're providing water to? But I wanted to talk about, coming back to the constitutional amendments that were presented at our last meeting, have they changed in any way? And I would like for Paul to address, are we there in, with, from the Constitutional Committee with language that we can support, but then also move forward with a statute to define?
I think what's important to understand and remember is that the Utah Supreme Court has not defined where they got into the constitutional prohibition. They've had an opportunity, and they kicked the can down the road because it was anticipated, for example, in this valley, the Salt Lake was annexed throughout the East Bench. And so the court did not have to address that issue. Well, now that we have 3 other cities that have incorporated within that area, that fiction no longer exists. And the next time it comes up, the court will have to probably address it. And I think what the committee was addressing is the concept that we would rather have the legislature and people define how we want that constitutional provision interpreted as opposed to a court. And so I don't think what we are doing is necessarily contrary to what the Constitution says right now, but I do believe that the Constitution as written is ambiguous and doesn't give us the protections we need. And I have seen enough experience now with the courts that I don't know that I want to roll the dice.
Yeah, I think the fact that we're even having this discussion tells us there's enough uncertainty that we ought to change where we're at.
And so let the legislature choose the language and the people will vote on it. So I think the committee has gotten close. It will recognize it. I personally think the legislature ought to like this constitutional amendment, because what it does is that it gives the legislature power to go in and fill in the details. Right now, last year, when you were presenting your first bill, Representative, you ran into the thing, well, this may run afoul of the Constitution. You see, we all were uncertain. So let's clean up the Constitution, and then the legislature knows what it can do and what it can't do. The cities and others know what they can do and what they can't do, and then we can fill in the blanks. That's why this amendment is important to go forward. I think we're close. I feel very good about where the committee came down at. There are the little details that have to be worked out, and that's fine by me.
If I were to make a motion, I would say whatever the committee is doing, with your blessing, because I trust you.
I'm glad you trust
me. It's not that I don't trust the other attorneys, but you live in the area that's affected. No, but Paul lives in one of the areas affected as an outside water user. So as an attorney, as a litigator, he knows the game, he knows the process. So if we're ready to say go forth and finish this and send it to us so we can review it, and if Paul has an addition, I would say that addition be incorporated and we're there on the constitutional amendment.
I just think it's important that the league be on board.
Yeah.
That everyone's on board. It's extremely difficult to pass a constitutional amendment, but we have done it before. And we can do it again if the water community is united on it.
Well, and if the people are with you, too.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Because the people have to vote eventually.
But the reality is, I think the way I would present it to the people is that this doesn't really change things. What it does is it clarifies ambiguity.
But you have to understand, I come also from a community standpoint, and we deal with a lot of those communities. You went to a community council the other night. See, I know where you've been. Because I get reports all the time of this is what's being said here, this is what's being said there, this is what they're up to. So at the end of the day, it's the people that will go to the ballot box, and if they see that this will bring some change and fairness to the service of the water community, that the people who are turning on their spigots and getting their bills are going to get fair treatment. It's our citizens that are going to make that decision on that constitutional amendment. You can refer anything, but if it doesn't have the goodwill of the people in mind,
well, that's why you need the
we're not passing anything, because I know how to go out and kill anything, and when it comes to legislation, you know that. And our citizens are just tired of having to come back and ask and beg for fairness. So let's get on with the program. Let's do a good amendment to the Constitution and then come up with some rules that'll make people happy. Because you won't be in business very long if you don't make those people happy.
All right.
So, Representative, so we had a motion and we kind of said, yes, we support it, the constitutional amendment. That was
subject to the league's final.
I mean, might I just give one view before we move on? And with that, and that's, we have an organization that we deal with the other western states, and I met with them 2 months ago, and no one else has this constitutional prohibition in the West, and they're all still alive. And so part of me wonders if we're making a big deal out of something we ought to just get rid of. I know that the league's been very concerned about not doing that, but that, in my mind, that's the other place. Instead of making it more complicated, is the other option to just say, let's get rid of this.
Now, what's the first thing we do?
All the water districts in Utah don't have this prohibition, and they're still alive.
And we do real well.
And you're saying a modernization, which is what I look at this change as, a modernization of a constitutional prohibition that really was a result of one act, unfortunate act, that now hampers some providers, but as you point out, others have no strings attached. And so we understand your point. There are some other subtleties in there, but we think that for reasons why when we looked at just getting rid of it altogether, we had some concerns. But we think that doing the changes, making the changes that we're doing now, what it does is at least frees up, as Paul said, the legislature now to put in some framework in there that we all can agree on and move forward with.
Okay. With that, are we ready to come back to the committee? I thought I'd just throw that poison pill out before.
Well, hey, I like it.
We always have that debate.
Let's have the free market rule, right?
Do I have a motion to support what's been proposed?
Which one, yours or theirs?
No, the one that, theirs, or whatever you want to propose.
I'm all for what you said. I mean, that would really.
I'll put the motion that we support what the Constitutional Amendment Committee's put together, drafted. With the caveat that Paul mentioned, they're seeking input from the league, but the spirit and content of that seems very good in my mind.
Okay. All in favor of that?
Aye.
Aye. Yes.
Is there anyone that opposes?
Aye.
You said aye, Ed?
Yes, aye.
Okay.
They only let senators qualify their votes.
Well, are you on board? But
in this meeting, anyone
I'm generally
can.
On board. I'm gonna look at the statute piece a little, you know.
Okay. All right. With that, we'll move on to item number 3. And I think we've talked around this quite a bit already today. So my question was, do we want to make recommendations that augment the constitutional amendment, act independent of the amendment, or both?
We always reject your solution, Lord.
I understand that.
I was thinking about this. I think it needs, listening in on the Constitutional Committee, they contemplated us addressing some details, but I think as we put that together, it ought to contemplate either the amendment passes or doesn't pass. And so anything that comes out of this group, I think, with Representative Coleman and others, would be good and stand whether there's an amendment to the Constitution or not. And I think we can do that from what we're trying to address. In terms of the definitions that Paulina mentioned, some clarification, either citing existing definitions in statute, we don't want to create definitions where there are
already
others.
We also need to make sure we reinforce that what Representative Coleman was asking for before. You have to show the map of your service area.
And that's solved if the constitutional amendment passes, because you amend your service area by an ordinance in the city. And so it's already of record when you do that.
But they have to match.
And then I'm just going off of what I think I heard you saying, Representative, was the transparency, you know, the map and the service area, there's that. I think you were also talking about the transparency of the water resources, you know, what you have and how you're delivering that.
The rate structure.
And then, yes, the transparency of your finances and master planning.
And capacity to serve.
Yes. Yeah, those are all really important.
You know what's come up too since the session and being at NCSL last week, there's grave concern nationally about infrastructure maintenance and replacement. And so I think we need to find the appropriate place to ensure, especially extra jurisdictionally, that when we talk about equity and fairness, that there's reliability, that when I pay for my water, that rate includes adequate and safe, timely repair and replacement and maintenance of the infrastructure. And that's come up in some of the committee meetings as well, as some of the areas are concerned that we have degrading systems that don't seem to be budgeted appropriately to maintain. And I don't know, I don't have any qualified opinion on that. It's just been asserted. But I know that it is an issue. That should be part of citizens relying on that rate, also supporting the system.
So Sandy City's council has brought this up in terms of Government Accounting Standards Bureau, Section 34 talks about accounting of municipalities and other things, but one of the elements they're seeking is an inventory of your system, asset management program that says, here's our assets and they're in good or bad condition and here's the funding requirement, and if you're okay with a water main break every day because you know it's impacting not very many people, here's the funding requirement, as opposed to if your water main breaks or your water quality is degraded to a certain level, it's going to require additional funding, that transparency. Mm-hmm. So I think part of that's in GASB 34. I'm not familiar with anything in state statute that requires that.
There is, as affects the large water conservancy districts, a few years ago, yes. There was a bill passed, and we assumed that was kind of
on
of
the Prep
a model,
60 sort of thing.
A model that might be applied to other organizations in the future.
That's okay.
So I think along with that is a consideration that the water system be treated as an enterprise, that revenues from water users should not be mingled in other operational budgets, but should be treated as an enterprise. And I again, that's been a concern that's raised. I don't know if that's happening. But it absolutely should not happen if it is. So I think that we should look to codify that. I think that also brings assurances that what you pay for, that fee is going to what you've been assessed for, which is what the courts have supported, but we have all over the place that's not practiced very consistently in all kinds of areas of government. But I think in this case, that is an added measure for reliability, at least knowing that what I pay for the water stays in the system to benefit my continued use of the water.
Can I ask, I feel like there is a section in the state code relating to municipal finances that does speak to the enterprise fund issue. I'm not sure if it's specific to water or if it's all enterprises, but it might be good to look at that section, because I know we've...
It's not.
There is a statute.
Yeah.
And it says you have to keep... and a number of years ago, the legislature amended it to make it more difficult to move money from one enterprise fund to another, or to the general fund. Mm-hmm. You have to go, cities have to go through hearings and other things.
Right.
I mean,
and
the legislature did look at that issue. It used to be, it was much more free. You could take any money from water and put it in the general fund.
Yeah.
Now the legislature has made them put it in enterprise funds. And there's a process that has to be followed down. Whether that process is adequate or not, that's up to you. I don't know. That's a city issue. Right. Districts, obviously, all our money goes straight back to the water system because that's all we do.
One of the things that we discussed with Tom was that the area, since there's such a large area that Salt Lake City serves outside its jurisdiction, that maybe within that area a separate administrative control board be established to deal with rates and to be active participants with Salt Lake City to determine, you know, where's the money going? Are we getting adequate? Because that'll go to the infrastructure. If there's a greater need that's being maintained, if there are issues, that group becomes an active participant in talking to constituents, like you have the three cities and the unincorporated areas that are left on the East Bench. There has to be a mechanism to involve those people to bring serious issues to the forefront. The way it's handled now, to have a rate hearing and nobody shows up, it's really not getting to the heart of getting people involved in helping solve your problem.
Paulina, I would say, and I think this is going to be part of your presentation, Rachel, but I would say that I totally agree with you on the public engagement side, and so does our city council. And so many, many years ago, our city council put into ordinance that we have some oversight by a public utilities advisory committee. So I have a 9-member committee, and it's a requirement that 3 committee members represent our outside city customers, and they review all of our rate setting, all of our capital improvement, all of our budgets, with an eye towards that. And actually, one of my committee members was involved as a PSC member for quite a long time, who represents the outside committee. So I just wanted to point that out because I'm not sure if
apparently the outside people don't know that, the most of them.
Well, and I'm not saying that our engagement is perfect and that we couldn't do more, and as we've mentioned, that, you know, when our system was built in the beginning in the 1920s or even earlier, it was all unincorporated county, that there was the idea that if you were going to receive water from Salt Lake City, you would be annexed, and for whatever political reasons, that didn't happen. And now we've got cities that have incorporated on top of water systems that have been there for a century. And so we're trying to adapt in terms of that representation. I can't tell you how many conversations I have with Mayor Silvestrini, with Mayor Peterson, and it's a good working relationship. And I think we should continue to collaborate on those relationships, and if there are ways that we can make representation more robust. You know, I've volunteered to go out to community council meetings, to city council meetings, and so a lot of it is us working with our elected officials for those communities now and making sure that they know who we are and we know what their issues are and what the constituent issues are.
Okay. I think after listening to you, Representative Coleman and Paulina talking with Laura, I saw Evelyn walk in. Evelyn Everton's our deputy mayor. We talked about our advisory board. We serve outside of Sandy, as does Salt Lake. There's a difference, though, between our advisory boards. Salt Lake's advisory board actually has a stipulation, I think, that you have to have representatives from outside the city on your board.
It's a required ordinance in our ordinance.
Sandy does not right now, and I have Evelyn's permission to say Sandy would support something like that. That sort of requirement in statute that says for those public water suppliers or cities that serve outside their districts, they have a governing or advisory board that reviews their infrastructure, their rate studies. That's the function of our board, but it doesn't have representation of, I would offer this language, distinct user classes. So for us, a class is those that are outside Sandy, don't pay certain taxes, and there's a different cost to serve them. This is other language I'd include. The cost of service is equitable and reasonable. And this is after a conversation also with John Dougal in the state auditor's office. The second example I give you, like Draper charges higher for up at Suncrest because it costs a lot more to serve that user class up there. It's not taxes that's a differential. It's just that. Now back to service. That means that we as a public water supplier can't say, oh, you're outside the city. We don't care about the water quality. We're not going to build that water main that improves the reliability of your fire protection. We have to do the same assessment of the performance of our assets. Now, one governing body and water provider might have a lower level of service. It's okay to have a certain number of breaks because we don't want to triple our water bill, whereas another group through the representative body may say that's unacceptable. We want to increase that level of service. So there's those issues there. The other, let me just add one other thing that Auditor Dougal mentioned is, as Paul said, the statute does allow those transfers from an enterprise fund. It just requires the advertisement and the public notice. There are certain ones that really lend themselves to a cost of service, a payment in lieu of taxes, a franchise fee. If I have to go buy an easement across Boyer's property, I've got to pay 50% of face value of that land. If I put it across Sandy City streets right now, I don't have to pay for that. Right, but there's franchise fees. There's other. I don't have a lawyer on staff. I use the city attorney's office, and I'm charged a fee for that. But the auditor, John Dougal, said we don't have to have a nexus. A city can just transfer money, whatever they want. They just have to communicate that to the public. We want to go build a $50 million facility, and we're going to charge the water department for that. They can do that. They just have to go through the process. That is a public policy conversation that, as a water provider, I don't know if the mayor would tell me not to say this, but I would love to have my resources, my pocketbook guarded from that sort of thing. That's a policy decision.
I feel the
I
same
think.
Way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. All the water providers are going to raise their hand. I don't know about this.
Every municipal water provider has that.
But I think when we go to the league, you know, those that are paying attention, there may be some consequences that ripple, to existing things in place. But that's a very good policy question, Representative.
I would wonder if there's a scenario where your water costs are less than your water needs.
That's
consistently.
Fact. I think you brought up another point that if we don't have that, that the requirement of whether it's an annual every 5 years or a master plan, the ones. The statute in Washington, at least when I was there, had a requirement for your water resources and had very strict requirements of what, back to your point, of what are the standards of that.
Right.
And then it had a separate section on your infrastructure. And it doesn't mean you have to fix everything, but you need to report the condition so that the public can know, mm-hmm. Oh, we ought to raise rates, or why are you not doing that. Those would be some things we could include either by statute or it might actually be in rule in some places.
Yeah. So this model of representation, though, you're going to implement a representation on some advisory
actually,
board?
Actually, I had asked Evelyn if we welcome the legislation, but I don't see why.
I was going to say, would you do that without being told to by the legislature? Because, that's
yeah.
the best of worlds,
yeah.
and people just do the right thing.
We're going to throw something in. I think we need to be a little careful here because we're talking about two pretty good-sized cities and, already established policies, ordinances, advisory boards, but you have to think statewide. Mm-hmm. How many cities do that kind of action? And I think it's a fairly limited number. I think our conversation about rates is a much larger conversation than perhaps this committee can take on right now. And I think it's important to have a good conversation about rates. talk about what's the right size city to have an advisory board, because I don't think every small city in southern Utah, you know, middle Utah, needs an advisory board necessarily. They may only need a rate study for a certain period of time. So I think we need to be careful not to create a large burden for a lot of cities just because, you know, we've got one issue that we're trying to correct.
Well, that's why they have first-class county legislation all the time, isn't it?
Well, I think we have to think about it in a broader sense. It's not just about Salt Lake or Sandy or Provo or whoever.
Well, and it's not just first-class cities necessarily. Right, because it's a choice they've made to serve a large area outside their boundaries.
Well, that's why I chose the language governing and or advisory body. So I know at Sandy and Salt Lake and the other larger cities, you know, you want to go for the council for everything because it just bogs things down. But a smaller, we'd have to check with the other, through the league and otherwise, make sure that whatever language would fit a small town. Because the issue that the representative brings up and Paulina, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones got served by the city, and now they've been cut off because, you know, there needs to be some sort of due process, I think, is what we're seeking here, and a voice.
And there are good issues that are being raised. You know, the conversation about sustainability of a water system, you know, and is the city preparing for the future replacement of a water system? It's a great conversation to have. I think there's lots of cities that are not looking that far down the road. But I think it's a broader conversation that perhaps maybe we're prepared to take on right now.
Yeah, could be consequences.
So to drag us back, Mark.
Yeah, can we come back to item number three on the agenda?
Yeah.
So from my perspective, I think there are some things theoretically you could do independently of the constitutional amendment, but my concern is that if we try to run or prepare language that anticipates an either-or, or we try to do something that says, well, we're going to do this independent of the constitutional amendment, my concern is that if we do that, it will further complicate things. To me, it seems like we need to prepare companion language that goes with the constitutional amendment, not independently. If the constitutional amendment fails, then we would need to come back and figure out how to make the language work in light of the constitutional amendment not happening. But even the idea of posting a map, if the constitutional amendment passes, the city might, I don't know for sure, but it might do a different designated water service area than if it doesn't pass, because of whatever spillover effect as people try and think about that. And so, to me, it seems like that we should support augmenting the proposed constitutional amendment with proposed language that would, you know, come into effect at that time, but not acting independently. That would be my motion.
Okay. We have a motion. Any discussion?
So the augment that you're talking about is not to the amendment itself, would be to statute?
To statutory implementation of some of the things we're discussing consistent with the Constitution.
Yeah.
So they work as a package.
I'll second that.
Second.
Yeah, I have a question. So are you precluding other pieces? I mean, would you suggest that we preclude other pieces of legislation such as we had in the last session? And only focus on this? Is that what you're saying?
I think the primary focus should be towards how we anticipate implementing the constitutional amendment. If there's something that we all agree could be done separately, I think then we can talk about that. But I think our primary focus should be on augmenting the constitutional amendment. Obviously, legislation can be run separately, but I just think that the complexity of passing legislation next year and then trying to make that match up with a constitutional amendment a year later, I think is going to be problematic. I think let's do it right rather than doing it fast.
So you're just suggesting things that would impact the constitutional amendment. Not necessarily like my transparency and accountability bill, which doesn't necessarily impact that.
I think they do, though. I think that they all impact the constitutional amendment as far as the concept of a designated water service area, the fact that the constitutional amendment says that there will be ordinances adopted to implement that,
I think they all do tie together, even though they might seem like, oh, transparency is completely separate. But as soon as we're talking about how do cities implement designated water service areas, it all comes back to the fact that the constitutional amendment authorizes that and then creates these three levels of with the existing level, but then, you know, designated water service area, surplus watering. I think all of that are things that cities have to be able to consider at the same time. And so I do think it's a problem to do one of those things independently of the others, which is why I made the motion the way I have.
And that's the discussion I wanted to have. So.
Well, here's the thing that I have a clarification on. As you know, the legislation that you draft legislation that only takes effect if the constitutional amendment it passes. We've done that before.
Yeah, right.
Is that what you want to limit this committee to?
Yeah.
Because isn't there changes that need to be made regardless of what happens to the Constitution? I mean, don't we see a need to make some improvements in Title X and the water system regardless of what we do? See, the difficulty I have, Mark, and no offense, is that if we are not truly, if we're just clarifying the Constitution and modernizing it, then in fact we ought to proceed to improve the statute. We don't have to wait for the Constitution to pass in order to do things. And I think there's some preliminary steps that should be taken regardless of whether the Constitution passes or not.
I'll tell you why there's a problem with that. Right now, the Constitution tells me, as a city attorney, that my obligation is to my inhabitants. Right? The Constitution says your obligation, the proposed Constitutional Amendment says your obligation is to the people in your designated water service area. Well, that's different. And how legislation implements one is different than how it implements the other. I'm not saying we should ignore that. I'm not saying we should make it a huge problem. And in fact,
how do you provide service right now outside your boundaries if you do? I don't know if Auckland does.
We do very limited, maybe 100 connections outside of our city.
But like I said, the difficulty is last year, Representative Coleman made a bill in which we just wanted to see some maps and some basic transparency. There's no reason at all a bill like that can't be carried and passed in the legislature regardless of what happens to the Constitution.
But a map showing where I serve outside of my city is different potentially than a map showing my designated water service.
That's fine. Change the title on your map later after the Constitution passes, but give us the map.
I withdraw my second.
I think the legislature is going to do what it wants
so
anyway.
So if we want to do a map...
There's that.
So right, obviously. So if That goes back to my point, though. If there are some things that clearly are different and that can be implemented immediately and they're not going to have a conflict, I don't have an issue pursuing those. But I think our primary goal, if we're really going to give the certainty that I think you've expressed that you want, Representative, is it's going to accompany the Constitution. If there are some simple things that clearly stand on their own, I don't have a problem with us pursuing those as well. I just think our primary focus should be on figuring out the accompanying language.
My thought is that we ought to have something come out of this body talking about the specifics. At least the clarity that I have obtained just kind of listening to you, Representative, you know, the transparency, the accountability, the equal treatment that, you know, I've had to defend myself and say we do treat all of our customers outside of Sandy City the same, but there's been historical misstatements and things like that come back, and to be honest, that confusion, one, is a problem for the person that feels that way, but then it becomes a problem for my department, and then by extension my administration and mayor to say no, we that was old news. And so I think the things that the representative was seeking to address have merit, maybe in my mind actually more important than the constitutional amendment, because the constitutional amendment we've had good attorneys kind of have what I'll call workarounds that respect the Constitution as is, but have this little bit of, I'll call it, uneasiness for folks. That was what that was addressing, whereas the transparency, equal treatment, to Paulina's note, that how people are feeling about their, I think we should be trying to address those. And I think, Representative Coleman, you're not the only one that this is an issue for. If we don't come out of this committee with that, I wouldn't be surprised that we see something anyway.
I think this discussion is really good, too, and the discussion over the legislative session was good. I mean, we've already taken steps to change what we have on our website based on feedback we received during the session, and, you know, because we don't know what's not transparent to somebody unless they tell us all the time. So, you know, I think if anything comes out, you know, if there's a requirement legislatively, that's fine. But I also think that we can do it on our own, too. Yes. We know what is being, what's being asked for. And we already have a map on our website of our service area. We already have our budget posted. We know what our capital improvement program is. You know, maybe Paulina wants it a little different so she can see exactly what's being planned for the infrastructure that serves Paul, right? So what treatment plant projects are planned, what pipeline projects are planned, how do you get to the rate differential, which is something that we just posted on our website as well, so that people understand the principles behind it. So, you know, I think that there is plenty of room for us to be working on that right now without legislation.
And my only concern is the elephants get is this big. And if we're going to get something done, where do we want to put our energy?
Well, I think I've taken, as I've been listening, it's definitions, the transparency, the accountability, the infrastructure. I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed, but I think I'll go do some homework on, I think we have pieces that are already addressed, at least for the larger districts, and maybe we can steal from their legislation that came about under Prop 60 and that framework. Because I'm sensing from not just Representative Coleman, but a larger body of our legislators and our customers even, a need for this. Now, Mara, I think you're right. We can do it without the legislation, but I...
Yeah, I'm not saying that we ignore that. That's not the point here. The point is that the legislation you run, if the Constitution passes, is not necessarily the same as the legislation you run if the constitutional amendment doesn't pass. Now, there may be some things that are fine either way, but cities will make different determinations about how they implement this if the constitutional amendment passes than if it doesn't. So I'm saying that it's a matter of a year trying to figure that out.
Mike Styler's been asked to give a recommendation.
Right, and the recommendation that I'm proposing is that we get language that will help implement the Constitution.
Okay.
Because that's where this is all headed.
That's how I heard you the first time. You suppose what comes out of this group dovetails in with the proposed constitutional amendment, and don't waste our time with trying to write it for two pieces.
Yes.
I'm with you there. I support that. And so it's not saying no to writing anything, it's just for the future.
As Paul stated, if the constitutional amendment fails, then we don't pass the other piece. If there still has to be another piece, because if I look at all of these definitions, have nothing to do with people and service.
I would pose that we draft something, and when we get done writing it around the proposed constitutional amendment, I would be surprised if we look at it and say if it changes very much if the constitutional amendment doesn't pass.
That piece should pass independent of the Constitution.
But I hear, Mark, that we don't want to be trying to chase two different targets. Set the target is with the constitutional amendment, but we ought to visit that before we make a recommendation to Styler.
The constitutional amendment is also dealing with possibly the sale of infrastructure. Waterworks.
But that doesn't impact the issues we have of transparency account. All of those things are
transparency
separate.
Transparency is the way of the world and the law anyway. It shouldn't be contingent upon the constitutional amendment passing. You're either transparent or you're not. You know, that's just.
So I'm going to restate in my understanding Mark's motion and make a second, and I think maybe aligns with what you thought it was. Mark, you're saying that, yes, we should pass legislation, but if we do, but it needs to be aligned with the proposed constitutional amendment, so we're not chasing back and forth. It also gives a message. When I heard you say that, it gives a message to the legislators that we think they're both good together as a package. I would say as we get towards the end of it, we got to look at that and say, I think Mike Styler would want to know, the legislator would want to know, what happens if we don't pass the other one? What happens in the interim? Can we have it become effective next year before we have an opportunity for a constitutional amendment? Is it still valid? I'd be surprised if we don't end up without changing the document, but it ends up being relevant under both scenarios. But I'm agreeing with you, Mark. If we're trying to chase two things, we end up writing two different things, and it's just going to be a mess.
Yeah, well, and I think from the fundamental standpoint of certainty, it's if you don't do the constitutional amendment, there's a whole question there that you can try to write all kinds of statutes around and chase your tail, where if the constitutional amendment passes, you probably don't have to do anything. So that's why I think it's important we decide where we're headed.
So, Tom, did you end up seconding Mark's motion?
Yes.
Was that the second?
Okay. All in favor?
Yes.
Anyone opposed?
No.
We have two no's.
Not.
Are you still there, Ed?
I am.
Did you vote aye or?
I'm aye.
Okay. He's with Washington County Water Conservancy District. Okay. Let's move on. I've invited Rachel Otto to come and talk about, from the League of Cities and Towns, about nationwide best practices on rate setting.
Thanks. I don't want to take up too much time. I know we have made it very far to the agenda, but not far enough. So today, I think this conversation generated from our conversation in the last meeting about how cities set rates, both for customers inside their jurisdiction and outside their jurisdiction, and what level of arbitrariness is inherent in that or not inherent in that process. So, I am by no means an expert in how to set rates or perform rate studies. There's a lot of expertise around this table that I would welcome input on from a practitioner standpoint on this, but my intention here is just to kind of introduce some of the nationwide best practices that are in use in some cities in Utah and maybe generate a little bit of discussion and potential for whether or not that these kinds of best practices are appropriate in statute or rule here in Utah. So, my presentation is mainly taken from the American Water Works Association Principles of Water Rates, and that's where most of this info comes from. So, just to go back to what the objectives are of cost-based rate making, and again, this is the overarching principle here is that water rates should match what the cost of providing the service is. So, cities, the best practice here is to recover those costs. And the other objectives there are to promote stability and predictability in the revenue that the utility generates or needs, to promote conservation and efficient use, fairness and apportioning costs among different kinds of ratepayers, whether it's residential, commercial, industrial, avoidance of undue discrimination and subsidies within rates, which is something that I know this committee has been dealing with throughout the interim, efficiency in responding to supply and demand, rates that are simple and easy to understand and administer, and then rates that are legal and defensible so that, you know, if they are challenged by different classes of ratepayers, they can hold up and, a city can show the process that was done to set these rates and defend that process. So the overview of the rate setting process that the AWWA recommends is this three-part analysis, or it's really three categories of technical analysis. And there are different methodologies that are within each of those analyses. So there's the revenue requirement analysis, which is really the operating and capital costs that determine a city's total revenue requirement. And there are two generally accepted approaches within that. So two generally accepted approaches to projecting total revenue requirements. So there's the cash needs basis and the utility needs basis in there. And then there's some flexibility within those two items as well. So none of this is really a one-size-fits-all approach. This is kind of an overarching structure that a city then can tailor, or a utility can then tailor to meet what the objectives of that community are. The second analysis within the cost-based system is the cost of service. So the cost of service the cost of service analysis is intended to allocate and equitably distribute revenue to different customer classes of service. And again, there are two generally accepted methodologies for how to determine the cost of service. I won't get too far into details here since we don't have a lot of time. But again, within the cost of service, two different ways to calculate that for cities and some flexibility within that process too. And then finally, the actual design of the rates, which after performing the first two analyses, the city basically uses those results and then establishes the cost-based water rates that meet the goals and objectives of a particular community to actually design the rate structure in that city. So just a little bit more detail on the revenue requirement analysis. There's two different methodologies, the cash needs and utility basis. And the two approaches are essentially similar except for how they fund capital infrastructure. Cash needs uses debt service and capital expenditures funded from rates, while utility basis uses depreciation, expense, and a return on rate base. So that's kind of the fundamental difference between those two approaches. Many utilities use a hybrid of those two approaches, which is also acceptable according to the AWWA if they serve customers both in and outside the jurisdiction. And the cash needs basically treats owners, which are people who live within the jurisdiction, as investors in the system, and then they use the utility basis for suburban customers who are kind of considered the non-owners in the system. And I'll go into a little bit more of that here down the road. So the cost of service analysis, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Utilities consider different service characteristics, different demand patterns for their different classes of customers. And of course, establishing the customer classes is a whole other process that a city can go through depending on what that utility looks like. So is it mostly residential? Is it commercial? Is it industrial? What different classes are within the utility that need to be addressed? How much does a utility want to differentiate between classes and their different usage patterns? So it can be more or less complex based on how the utility is serving. And then again, the rate design analysis. You will see cities that are using this methodology will, for example, have a lot of public engagement around what the goals and objectives of the utility actually are. So Laura talked about what Salt Lake City does as far as the PUAC, where they, by ordinance, require different users from different customer classes to participate in this committee and develop what the objectives should actually be for designing rates. Do they want to focus on affordability? Do they want to focus on underserved populations and how to make sure that water rates are affordable for those populations? Do they want to focus on efficiency, predictability? And then, of course, legal defensibility is also part of the discussion there. How defensible are their rates? If they are challenged, can those rates hold up in court as being, reasonable for all classes? So setting rates for outside the service area, the AWWA has a great deal of analysis and information on this, which is a nationwide practice. Again, inside the city are owners, outsiders considered non-owners. And the reason for that is, for what you all, I'm sure, already know. So the non-owner, or what they term non-owners, are not responsible for operating the system to the regulatory standards. They're not responsible for the repayment of debt. They have no legal liability, no responsibility for the payment of property taxes that benefits utility or build infrastructure, repair infrastructure, and as has been pointed out, no legal standing in the governance of the utility, most generally speaking. And then the capital investment in operations and maintenance expense to serve non-owners is greater. So, again, as we all know, or as we imagine, in certain systems, there's a similar investment for getting infrastructure and getting service to residents, but fewer customers per lane mile. So the calculation is different for people within and without the jurisdiction. So there are benefits, of course, to providing outside service, and then there are also risks of providing outside service. So we already talked about that. So in exchange for that risk, the non-owners typically across the country in this practice pay a differential. They pay a higher rate than people within the jurisdiction. And, you know, it's up to the utility to determine what is reasonable there and what those costs actually are to serve residents or to serve customers that are outside the jurisdiction versus inside the jurisdiction and come up with something that's legally defensible for that differential.
Okay, so that, I mean, that's consistent with the court case we have here. Is that the Tory case?
Yeah.
But really there should be recourse for a user short of litigation. So what is recourse to challenge a rate of a non-owner?
Well, I mean, it's going to be different depending on where you are, and I think it's an interesting policy question that you bring up as to whether or not court is not a good remedy. I think Steve Clyde left, but last time he pointed out that mediation, of course, is always an option. There's been different suggestions as far as the PSC or the Ombudsman's Office. Or some kind of an advisory board. I don't know that that's something that, we would necessarily support, particularly some kind of a group of non-elected people who then are making that determination if the complaint is that, people don't have a vote. I don't know that placing another non-elected administrative board somewhere in the middle there is really helping.
Really, judicial review should be the last. I mean, litigation should be a last recourse, not the only.
Well, I think, here, my perspective, and people who have litigated these cases, I know probably have, a lot more to say. Litigation, while, I practice in many other administrative realms, and litigation is always the last resort, whether or not your first right is with the court or your first right is with an administrative body, there's a ton of steps that people take before they ever file a lawsuit in court. They will go to Marisol Vestrini and complain, and or they will, they will go to their committee. I mean, there are other steps that are taken before they end up filing.
But where there is this disenfranchisement because the non-owner rate payer can't affect their voice through an elective process, then the only other thing is court, is litigation. It seems like there really should be something different, especially when, because it is such a vital need that they have no other choice. They should have, the less power you have, the more due process you should have. I think as a rule in America,
I have a question for you on that, though. But so, do you think it's more important that they be able to have opportunities for process before the rate is imposed or after?
I think both. I mean, we as owners and citizens in any other service sector, you affect both.
Well, and
you on the outset and the
I understand what you're getting at here, and again, I think it's a good conversation to have. When we did our survey that we're still working on, many entities responded that if they do, when they are setting rates for both in and outside, but they both provide notice and give the opportunity to be heard, the same to outside customers as inside customers. So it's there's nothing that prevents an outside customer from coming to a city council meeting or to the budget process or whatever and expressing those frustrations. I understand the voting issue, and I think that's hopefully accounted for by better public engagement. And I think that's one of the best practices that we should talk about is what public engagement is right for certain size utilities and how can utilities do it better.
But in the end, that non-owner is not empowered. He can call Silvestrini, but can't vote her out.
And, you know, I think the example last time that we talked a little bit about was a business owner who has a business in another city that doesn't live there. It's sort of the same thing. You know, you have so much say over the business licensing process or whatever fees you're paying in that other city, but you don't necessarily have the vote to get that person off the city council.
I don't think that's the same. I think maybe practically it looks the same, procedural-wise, but being a homeowner resident, depending on water, I don't think is a good comparison to if I choose to operate my business in another city. And I hope nobody ever says, then move. Because I've heard that too, but no, that's not acceptable. It just seems like they are disenfranchised. There should be something short of litigation to affect due process for fundamental need. And I know you're just giving us.
Yeah, right. I've had varying levels of success in different fora of administrative law, and at the end of the day, it adds expense, it adds time. You know, putting an administrative body there to hear rates appeals, to me, just sounds like it's lengthening the process and making it more expensive. At least that's what I have seen with my own clients, but it's a worthwhile discussion.
I think on the ownership issue, many of the people on that east bench had water systems that were purchased. It's not like the city had all this abundance of water and went out and sought customers. They took on customers as they took on water systems.
Can you provide an example for that, Paulina?
Mm-hmm.
Can you provide an example for that? I'm not aware of.
Well, how did Salt Lake City acquire all those water rights on the East Bench from the old water users?
Through exchange agreement.
Sandy City purchased Union Jordan. That's an example.
Yeah, but
Sandy City wanted to purchase White City Water. That's an example.
Okay.
So existing customers. Mm-hmm. The situation changed. The city became the owner, and now they have no recourse because the city is the owner. That's the hard part to deal with.
And I'm not really familiar with the White City piece, but
many of the ditch companies provided.
But the ditch company, I just want to make sure that we all understand the historical context here, because at one time, all of that East Bench was agricultural. And yes, there was water being run through ditches. The water would subside by the later crops, and the farmers were in trouble. They needed some additional water supply. And so the ask was to do some exchanges where the city would build the irrigation system from Utah Lake. And then in some cases, they asked us to build their culinary system for them. So it wasn't us taking over someone else.
Didn't Mill Creek have another? It was the old White family had a.
So there's one example that
water system that failed.
Water system started failing, and they didn't want to put the money into it. I think Salt Lake City took that.
But still, the customer base became a victim to a bad decision.
Let me finish on that instance.
The customer base came and said, "Can somebody please help us?"
Yes.
So you know, it's. No good deed never goes unsaid.
Right.
Yeah, same old adage.
So sort of like it's. I just want to make sure. I mean,
but
I'm
that
not
is an example
saying,
of a takeover.
But I think Rachel's just pointing out that in terms of setting rates and that equity, as a resident in my city, I get to speak to my governing body. Anyone else can come and speak as well. I think you bring up the business person can speak to the governing body. They just can't vote. On the other hand, the option that each of these individuals have is they can go spend a lot more money, create their own water system, and whatever we end up with, it would be a travesty that we create a situation where a city can provide water, is capable of it, but they're not going to because of now you have an entity forcing them to do things that are against their best interests of their constituents. If they're required to treat all the customers equally, that's one thing, right? You know, so we have two customers treated equally. I appreciate the distinction you make, Representative, about the difference between someone that votes or doesn't vote, but I think, in my view, the better piece of public policy would make sure, if we don't already have in rule and statute the equal treatment of a customer, of a retail customer within that service area. The piece, you know, the drafting that I'm seeing so far really, in my mind, gets to the heart of what you're looking for, is that they're treated equally. You're always going to end up with some people that are upset, right? And some, well, I'm paying 30% more than the person across the street while I'm not doing the taxes. But I, anyway, I sorry to interrupt,
no,
Rachel.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
No, I mean, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to add on. We were talking about the East Bench and established water companies. And up in the canyons, we have several examples of the city acquiring not water companies, but water rights that were allowing water companies up in the canyons to operate. And they acquired those rights, went to the state engineer and said, okay, we're going to provide the same amount of water that that company or that water right was allowing at the time. He transferred it up there, then set a water surplus contract up for much less than what was proposed or had been originally being provided. So we have a situation where in the case of Pine Tree, for example, which is the one I'm familiar with, we had 66 lots that were being the community had bought, or was leasing, I guess, water from a ditch company for sufficient water for 66 lots in that subdivision. These are platted lots by the county. The city bought that water, or bought those rights, filed a change application to move those rights up in the canyon for those 66 lots, and then proceeded to file a surplus water agreement with the Pine Tree Water Company for about 44 lots. So all of a sudden, just like Paulina was talking about, that all of a sudden we had a system that was apparently working, and the city comes in and buys it, and then all of a sudden things change and we have no voice and they're just dictating. Same thing happened here, where all of a sudden that community lost what appears to be the right to develop those other 20 so or 20 something.
So Norm, I need to respond to that. In the Pine Tree instance, that
can we? Can I interrupt this discussion?
Becomes a matter of record.
We're going to lose Representative Coleman.
We can go back.
Can
to
we
that.
Schedule another date quickly before you go?
Yes, thanks.
I'm thinking like, we're going to get somewhere, we got to get moving here. Is a week too soon or 2 weeks? What is our date next week?
That I think we need to provide something to, not to represent or to Styler, but we really want to represent what you'd like to see, Representative.
So do we need something for the interim on the 15th?
Well,
they had Boyd and others reporting.
We just have a progress report next.
These bill would just report how great the Constitutional Committee did. Oh, sorry.
Is next week too tight? Do we need to get out 2 weeks? I mean, I could meet basically any day next week if there's a day that.
So,
the week of the 20th?
Monday, I've got Administrative Rules Committee at this time, and then they're doing appropriations on the Tuesdays before interim, so that's kind of hit and miss.
Do we want to try to do it Tuesday?
I could do Tuesday. We have to be a little later. I have an appropriations meeting in the morning at 8:30. Probably wouldn't be done by 10.
Is it Tuesday afternoon a possibility, next Tuesday?
The 14th. It does work for me.
1 o'clock?
Can we do 2?
2? Does that work for everyone?
What day?
Tuesday the 14th?
2 o'clock.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Yeah, if that's okay, I'll arrange it for here, Tuesday at 2 o'clock.
Dora?
Yes.
On Tuesday, are you involved at all with the Water Development Commission or the Appropriation of Natural Resources?
I know there's a field trip.
They're doing a big field trip that day.
And I'm planning to sing Kent, so. Unless he reverses the order on me, we should be good.
Okay. And there's a number of legislative meetings, appropriation meetings going on that day.
Yeah. She was talking about that, too.
So, yeah, there's appropriation meetings that whole day.
But hopefully.
So I wasn't able to pretty quickly check her calendar for her to see what committee meetings she had.
Okay. And I'm presuming we may end up with her in a phone, on the
she
phone instead of in purpose,
in,
instead
sure
of
she
in
she
person.
Sure but, she was on.
Is it all right? I mean, we're having a lot of dialogue about rate setting. And obviously, that's probably going to be something we're going to spend more time on. I wondered, to help us get the agenda ready for the next meeting, if we could move to the next item on the agenda. And just what I was thinking was, I would entertain motions on any of these ideas or anything else that you want us to focus on. And the ones that get the votes are the ones we'll spend the time on. So.
Yeah, we could just do an up down. Yay, nay. Just look at them, and you
want
to do that?
Do you want? I can do that.
Yes, no, or discuss later. Should we do
okay.
that?
Okay. So let's start with A. All who want to.
Yes.
So are we talking about preparing some kind of legislation for these items, or just talking about these items?
By talking about them and potentially entertaining legislation.
So things that we talk about that might lead to legislation.
Yeah.
But
because I don't think we have time to just keep talking about things.
Right.
5A, I would say that if you're looking for something a little more than a yes-no, is my thought is that this body wants to affirm the continued ability of cities and other entities to enter into contracts to sell water.
And I think the way things are right now, we've supported the constitutional amendment, so we've already affirmatively said that.
I think so.
So B, whether cities choose to provide water service outside their jurisdiction should be bound to continue the service offered perpetually or a date certain once they start service. I think this is tied also to the constitutional amendment. If they're within the service area, they're treated the same. If they're outside the service area, I don't think any government entity wants to be bound by. They can enter into agreements.
By contract.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Contract law. So.
Contract law.
And it, I mean, I think they could deal with contract law if the constitutional.
But I don't think that the, we don't want a statute to bound them to that for service in perpetuity.
Under the Constitution, anyways.
Well, under the way it is now, I think they're in a bad place trying to do that.
Then there needs to be some kind of definition with regard to what establishes a service area. It just seems to me that once. Anybody becomes a
that's in the constitutional amendment, Norm. It talks about defining their service area, who they
yeah,
serve.
Yeah, I know, but I was going to ask a question about that as well. I mean, is this going to be totally
I've got to run
the,
too,
the
but
city?
But we're just making an agenda for next time.
Oversight by some regulatory authority, legislative or whatever. Because if a city gets to choose what you know, whatever their service area is, and they just and without any accommodation or areas where they have a monopoly of the utility, and they just for whatever reason, say, well, even though we've got a monopoly there, we're not going to include that as in the service area, then, you know, then you have nothing to, you're basically at
mercy. Rome, I would propose this, that we talk about his distinction is looking for, you know, claiming that his cabin up in Big Cottonwood gets claimed within Salt Lake City's service area. I think that's different than someone that lives in Mill Creek that's receiving
correct.
Water. And we can talk about that specifically. You're looking for answers to those questions.
And my question is, does the committee want to go into that area?
I think
because I think the service area one's solved with the Constitution.
I think given our support of the Constitution, we've implied that we're interested in talking about this because there are two scenarios here that are covered in the Constitution.
Okay.
But the language, I don't support the language, but we got to talk about this is what I'm hearing you say.
So right. All in favor of talking about it?
Yes.
Anyone opposed? Okay.
Item C, I don't think they should be bound, but I think we should talk about that. That's, in fact, that's a case that Draper, I think, and WaterPro went into, forcing WaterPro to sell to Draper, or there's other instances.
I think item C is a huge distraction right now.
Okay.
I think there is no good
I like that.
Place to go with item C. I personally would not support talks about item C.
Do you want to make a motion?
Proposal.
I second
motion. Mark's proposal.
Do not discuss item C.
All in favor?
Aye.
Do not discuss item
anyone
C.
Opposed? Okay, so item C scratched.
Okay, so Mark's scratching something. Maybe I should look at it.
Item D.
Not already addressed. Do I really need to talk about
it? Oh, I agree with you.
I don't know if it is addressed in the statute.
It is addressed in other statutes.
I think the answer is...
I don't know the answer.
This is what Coleman's looking for.
This issue on item D, standards of service, quality of service, I think that is a different division's responsibility.
Isn't that already... That's part of that statute that was last year, I think.
HB 303.
Might come into that.
Well, I guess if you adopt an ordinance to serve them, then they will be under the Constitution.
Yeah, I think you're going to be subject to that probably. But I think that's up to the drinking water to hash out, not for us to necessarily talk about.
This issue comes as Representative Coleman and others having a question about that. I think we can answer that it's in a certain statute and doesn't require action.
I think this is really the issue that she's interested in is the assurance of money being paid into the system.
That comes
it's really back into infrastructure.
I also think it has to do with certainty of water planning. Like, are you actually planning for the future for that
right.
certain
and
area?
I think that's where she's at.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
To that extent, we have to discuss it.
Yeah, if it comes to equal protection kind of issues, I think
right.
we do.
That's fairness. But it's,
so I'm listening for motions.
Among the committees.
Well,
that we support D.
It sounds like we need to discuss it, Boyd.
Okay. All in favor?
Put it on the agenda.
Yes.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay.
I'm halfway there.
Say no if you don't want to. That's what I'm trying to do, thin out
I'm
things we don't
no,
want.
But I'm in the minority, so.
Item E, I don't think, is statutorial other than if we don't have a reference to, I think.
That's what you've been discussing this whole time.
Yeah, we spent a whole lot of time on it. Now the question is there desire in the committee to continue to spend time on it, or have we talked about it and you're comfortable
you need to come up with some type of process, because the fact is Representative Coleman or others are going to carry a bill whether you discuss it or not. They're going to come up with something.
And the question is, are we going to come up with something that's going to change that?
Like Fred has a proposal, he's trying to deal with
He's got somebody.
I think we should discuss this item. I don't know if we can commit to
language. I don't know that you saw it.
But I think we should.
Is that a motion?
Yeah, I would move that we continue to discuss this item, not knowing if we can come up with language.
I
think one comment I would add is I think it's a long-term issue. I indicated before, rates is, I think that's a huge conversation, and it needs to happen. But if we're talking about between now and September, you know, recommendations for Mike, you know, Styler, things like that, it's not going to happen in 2 months. And I'm sorry.
I also think you would be discriminatory if you said you're just going to focus that on customers outside a city's boundary, because we have to be defensible inside our boundaries, too.
I agree.
And
it's a much bigger issue.
It's a huge...
Say you have to keep all your money in your water.
So,
well, that would be great, you know, but I guess... And actually, we do.
We will do it for you. We won't say it's your idea.
Well,
the answer to the motion, though, is that we ought to look at this and come up with a recommendation, whether it's, as Styler said, it's either we propose legislation, we don't propose, or we propose to study more. Mm-hmm. I mean, that might
be where we end up.
Yes. Yeah. And honestly, if I could vote to just study it more right now, I'd say we should plan on studying it more. But if we need to talk about it to get there...
You're not going
to
get there.
We'll probably need to...
I would agree with Mark.
I think we need to get something that says, here's why we need to study it more. Mm-hmm. He and the legislature needs to look at something that we produce that says, why do we not
have
something?
One of the simple things was is we talked about actually delineating it. What are the revenues you collect inside and what are the revenues you collect outside? That's a starting point.
And that's already published in a rate study and, you know, I mean...
I'm interrupting, but I need to get going.
No.
So
yeah, we are.
We will look at this one, right?
So, all in favor?
Yes.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Anyone? Okay. I haven't heard from you in a while, Ed. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm. Gave up on us.
All right, F.
That's tied to the constitutional piece on defining your service area, and then beyond that. I think the Constitution addresses this.
Well, the question...
Now, this is actually ones that aren't in your service area.
I think this is Norm's question.
Yeah, this is Norm's question.
Which is somebody under subsection A of the Constitution,
where
you provide them water, but they're not part of your service area.
Okay, let's look at this one, then. I propose we look at this one.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. All right, G...
I think that this item we should not discuss because I think that, again, HB 303 has really dealt with this, and I think that drinking water will work on that.
All in favor?
Yeah, let's wait for... I agree with Mark. A.
Any opposed? Okay, we'll strike that. H.
I think H really is already going to be discussed with E. So I do not think that, first of all, there are huge problems with H right now. I think let's see what comes out of E before we talk about H. So can I say, my motion would be don't talk about H and
see what legislation comes.
Well,
or answers to the issue about the rate setting and other...
Why don't you just put it within the rate setting process?
Yeah, I think we should discuss
this. We'll have a good discussion on the rate setting process.
Right.
Period. So strike it as being redundant to the rate setting process.
Yes,
I like it.
Yeah.
Anyone opposed to that?
Okay. I always like the word redundant.
Aye.
Absolutely.
Do you want to talk about this? That's the question.
No. Just talking about the definition of service area, if they've defined their service area to be outside the city, they need to perfect and have...
Boy, I think what's important about this one, though, is I hope Representative Coleman is not under the wrong impression that a city can just expand its service area without any considerations.
Can we?
Because... there will be limits because they'll bump into other public water suppliers.
Yeah, and we maybe talk about what this really means.
Yeah.
Or do you want to?
Well,
I don't want to talk.
The other option is we don't have enough time to talk about everything, so...
Isn't this one of the unmentionables?
Aren't we in the middle of an adjudication right now?
We don't have time for a point. I would suggest you pass.
And do I have a motion?
Laura, did you make a motion?
Can I? I'm not on the committee, but I'm happy
to. Oh, sorry. Dave, did you want to make a motion not to talk about this?
I think due to time constraints, I would say no on this one.
Anyone opposed? I presume if you're not opposed, you're...
Anytime you want me to make a motion.
Item J.
I forgot.
I would just move, that you check in with the representative and just make sure that, you know, we're...
One of my goals is that we hear the things that she would like to, that are, she feels compelled to be discussing in the legislative session. We have an opportunity to, you know, share.
Okay. I think there's several topics. If Mike wanted to extend this committee or form another committee to talk, you know, in the coming year, there's several other topics, and this is a topic that would fall in that category in my mind.
So we have four items we're going to discuss. Is that right? B, D, E, and F.
Yeah, I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, we'll solve that, G.
All right. Thank you all for your time today.
Thank you.
We'll end. Thank you.
Thanks, boy.
Thank you. See you.
Bye.
Bye.
Nice job, Rachel.
Apparently, it was really riveting stuff. That's kind of right.
How are you?
Thanks.